Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back, everyone. I'll introduce the speaker, then we'll have the talk, questions, and announcements at the end. We're very happy to have Shanfei Oaks with us. He is a queer Puerto Rican English with Puerto Rican English ancestry on ascended Pomo land in Northern California. Teaches Buddhism and somatic practice focusing on the integration of meditation, trauma resolution, and social justice. He received teaching authorization from Jack Kornfield and wrote his dissertation on extraordinary states in Buddhist meditation and experimental dance. He teaches with Spirit Rock Meditation Center, East Bay Meditation Center, Inside Timer, and elsewhere. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you so much. Hi, you all. It's good to see a bunch of your faces again. It's been a couple of years since I've been back. And like many of you, I'm sure, I'm sad that we aren't in the gorgeous space in the mission, but I'm sure what has happened with my own groups has happened here, where the loss of gathering in physical space has also meant the gain of gathering with folks who aren't physically local. So some of you may be from further afield. And I'd love to just start off with the ritual if you want to, dropping a little hello and your location, if you want to, gender pronouns, if you want to, into the chat. So we see just a stream of who's here. And I'll start by just repeating from the introduction that my name's Shanfei Oaks. Some of you might know me just as Fight. I took the Oaks as a married name. And I lived in San Francisco for a decade, in the East Bay for a decade or more. And I'm now up in Sonoma County on Southern Pomo land. I use he and him. And it's really a pleasure to be here. So we'll let the flow of hellos happen in the chat as I begin. I want to talk with you today about a few things. As I was thinking about the group this morning, I was thinking a bit about the other times that I've been there and the people that I met there, the kinds of questions that were asked, and just the feeling of the group, really, really enjoying the feeling of this group. And I want to speak a bit to the topic of difference and interdependence in a way. This is a topic that is deeply Buddhist, crosses over between the early Buddhist or Theravadan and the later or Mahayana approaches to Buddhism. I'm not going to be really philosophical here. I'm going to talk more about our direct experience of reality. But I also want to bring in some threads that might feel a little bit less familiar in relation to some of the Dharma you may be hearing, particularly around our relationship to what we call nature and the natural world, the non-human world. So Just a moment to see the chat. It's so lovely to see folks writing in from all over the place, and you know, lots of folks in, you know, SF in the East Bay, but also you know, welcome you know, Palm Springs, Santa Cruz, Kansas, Arizona. So blessings on the deities of technology that make it possible for us to gather with warm-hearted and like-minded folks really all over this this place. So I've been training myself out of saying good morning, because it might not be morning in the time zone where you are, but from the hills near the Pacific Ocean, good morning to everyone. So one of the core frameworks that the Buddha gives for why we would engage in spiritual practice, engage in Dharma practice, engage in the cultivation of wise action and meditative immersion and wisdom, is that we might come to recognize as we enter the doorway to practice, or really as we find ourselves inspired to do something about the mystery of this life, and that brings us to practice, we might have a realization about our relationship with the rest of the world, right? Sometimes the doorway into practice is really individual, personal, psychological. Like, I'm suffering, I want release from that suffering. That's a great doorway in. That's, I think, many of our doorways in. It was certainly mine. When the Buddha described his own suffering, he described the suffering of recognizing that he was attached to things that were unreliable. He was attached to sensual experiences, meaning anything coming in from the senses. He was attached to comfort. He was attached to his identity. He was attached to relationships, all of the normal healthy things that we might be attached to. Healthy in the sense of Western psychology doesn't mean, however, in a Buddhist sense, ultimately reliable. And so he would say things like, I asked myself, why was it that I was seeking things that were unreliable refuges, that I, subject to old age, sickness, and death, was also seeking those things that were subject to old age, sickness, and death? This is part of his inspiration to go off into seeking in the wilderness. He said, why don't I shave off my hair and beard, go out into the wilderness, and seek the deathless? So the Buddha begins his path really searching for a problem, for a solution to what he perceives as a problem. And the problem is that he doesn't know what to do with the experience of being alive in the face of death and loss. Like, we're going to lose everything we love and are attached to. That's a given. I think in a way, you know, so many of the great religions and philosophical systems and cultural material that we reckon with, even you know, all throughout pop culture, contain many, many different attempts to deal with this truth, right? I was watching, you know, some science fiction type thing recently, and, you know, the good folks were battling the bad folks. But when it really gets down to it, there's something about what happens when you die, and what about your soul, and, you know, this and that. And the Buddha was tormented by these same questions. So he comes up with this extraordinary path, first of all, right, that combines awareness practice and ethical practice, everything that if you've been around the Dharma for a while, you've been hearing loads about. He comes up with practice. When he realizes the truth or the freedom that he was seeking, he expresses it in a particular way. And he says that for countless eons of rebirth, he recognizes that he has been wandering through the field of experiences, which he calls samsara, the endless wandering. In the early Indian, you know, cultural context, means being reborn again and again and again in different kinds of bodies, different kinds of situations and states, some human, some animal, some spirit, some material, some immaterial, but all having the same basic experience of dissatisfaction. He says, it doesn't matter if you're born a god or a demon or a rat or a bug or a human, you're subject to the same basic storyline. You're dissatisfied. You're trying to figure out what will give you some satisfaction. It's not really working. And at some point, you know, God willing, or, you know, whoever, you stumble upon the Dharma. The Buddha stumbles upon it. He said it was like discovering an overgrown city in the middle of the forest that hadn't been inhabited for eons. And he realizes upon discovering this city that there's a path to this deathless, this freedom that he sought. When he attains that freedom then, right, he expresses it in terms of, I got free of this endless round of rebirth. This isn't going to be a talk on rebirth necessarily completely. So if that word makes you uncomfortable, as it does many of us in a post-Christian kind of monotheistic, secular materialist, whatever this Western culture thing is, that rebirth term makes a lot of folks a little itchy. If that's you, don't worry about it. I'm not going to try to convince you of anything, but I want to tell you how the Buddha talked about this path, because that concept is really central to it for a particular reason. He said, okay, I got free of that endless round of rebirth. And now there's no more coming to any further kind of existence. So I'm not coming back, he said. And of course, that teaching, goes hand in hand, and this is totally mysterious, but I'm just going to say it, goes hand in hand with the strange teaching that there was no one here to begin with, that there was not a separate individual to begin with. So what's he even saying? I was reborn again and again and again. And then in a different sentence, you know, sometimes in the same text, he says, you know, you could search for a soul or a separate essence or individual, and you won't find one. So this is really difficult to reckon with. Let's just put that aside for a second. This is the framework. I want to feel into for a moment, not this idea of freedom and getting off samsara or anything. I want to feel into the basic framework for a second with y'all. Partly for a very relative kind of cultural reason, which is that you might really just be by existing in contemporary culture, and you know, maybe by being somewhere in the vicinity of, you know, what we might call gay culture or queer culture or non-mainstream cultures of many kinds, and I don't want to project what words any of us use to describe our experience in relation to the general culture. But you might know something about difference. Difference, I'll say here, is the perception that two things, vague philosophical term, things, two experiences, two phenomena, have possibly some related qualities, but also have recognizably different qualities. So we might look at each other across the Zoom screen or across the cafe table or wherever we see each other, and we might have a spark of recognition, like we are both human. And I'm projecting that y'all are human. If I go by the early Buddhist texts, you could be any number of things. So respect to those who are not human and who are present, and they are. But let's say I'm first going to address the humans in the room. I'm looking at you. You're human. You look human. Some part of us goes, hey, human. Right. And then, of course, we do that in all sorts of different ways. Some of us might look at each other and be like, you know, hey, cisgendered man, if that's what we look like to each other, you know, we might say, hey, brother, hey, you know, person like this. We might do this in a million ways. We might say, you know, hey, fellow queer person. Right. We might say, you look like a socialist, you know, or whatever, right? Hey, person of a political persuasion that I might share something with or not. On and on and on and on, right? You look like you might be a fan of some particular band, but I, you know, hey, I recognize you. So we're seeing we're looking out for similarity all the time. This is kind of how we know who our people are, who our family is, chosen or otherwise. But we're also seeing difference. We're like, oh, you're different from all these other humans. And in our culture, Western culture, I'm going to say cultures descended from European culture that made its way to North America, in the case of many of us here, not all, emphasizes the individual. And so part of what I grew up with was an emphasis on, like, you're a unique individual, right? That's true. You're totally a unique individual. You're a beautiful, shining snowflake in all the best ways. I love being a snowflake. It's totally great. And you know, I melt when it gets hot out, you know, a million things. Snowflakes are great. And gorgeous, I might add. So, please, you know, shine on, snowflakes. But that teaching that we are a unique individual is beautiful, is helpful, is really healing sometimes, especially when we've been dismissed or diminished through various kinds of oppression. But it obscures something. And what it obscures is that it's based on an old idea that isn't Buddhist at all, right? It is a Western concept. It's based on a Judeo-Christian idea of the soul, that we have this unique, individual, permanent, lasting thing in us that defines us, that there's something in us that doesn't change, that's kind of intrinsic to the core of who we are, right? You have your soul. This concept is so deep in Western culture that it's really difficult, if you grew up in European descended cultures, it's really difficult actually to see through it. You can think to yourself, oh, I don't believe that anymore. I'm not in those belief systems anymore. I don't know what happens after we die. That's great. But we might notice, if we really feel into the experience of being a self of some kind, of being myself, that I really do have this sense that there is something that I just own. It's just me. It's mine. And you can't take it away from me because it's who I am. And this is important, like all sorts of really important social and relational glue and dynamism and eros and psychological interaction and relationship, all of that can be built on this beautiful thing. But the Dharma invites us to look at the world through a slightly different lens. And that lens requires that we at least hold as a possibility this idea that the experience we're having, we can think of as having had many different kinds of experience before we were in a human body. Essentially, a beginningless experience. And it really comes down to something that more and more I think is almost animist. Almost a vision that all of nature, by nature I mean everything in the universe, there's nothing that's not nature, but that all of creation, all of nature, all of the cosmos is in various ways alive, awake, and interacting, and can't be broken down to any separate selves. A metaphor for this, for us, I totally feel like a separate self. You know, I've got my biography, I've got my who I am, all that stuff. You know, mushrooms pop up in the forest. Though we think of the mushroom as the little thing with the stem and the cap. That bit, the visible bit that pops up in the forest after the rain, that's the fruiting body of the mushroom. But it's not the whole mushroom, right? It's not just that it has some roots. It's that that's the fruiting part that connects to a vast underground web of stuff, a huge network, the mycelium. So all these different mushrooms popping up are actually not separate bodies at all. They're all the fruiting or flowering visible part of a vast body. Now I want you to start. Now I want to take a moment, and we'll do a tiny short practice. And I'm going to ask you to think about yourself as if you were a mushroom. And any kind of mushroom, right? You can get trippy on your mushroom nature, but any little brown mushroom will do here, because it's really, this is a meditation really about maybe we could use the word Thich Nhat Hanh beautifully uses interbeing. So here's your body. Just take a moment and tune into your body. Notice where you are. Notice the room you're in. And feel in your body, the substance of your body, just noticing, this is my body. You don't have to really dig into sensation, but we're just contacting the physical or bodily nature. And then I want you to think about your last meal or your last few meals. Just bring to mind what you ate today, this morning, yesterday, last few days. Flash on a few dishes. And do that and kind of almost like visualize the food, remember eating it, and then feel again your body, how the food became the body. Can you distinguish now the food from your body? Is there a moment when the food stopped being food, started being your body? Think about what was in the food for a moment. And just flash on some of the plants, liquids, animals, substances that were in the food you ate. And see if you can just flash for a moment on where they came from. A garden somewhere, a farm, a ranch, the woods, a factory. But everything grew in some form, right? If you ate animal flesh, those animals ate plants. If you ate plants, those plants grew in the dirt, receiving sunlight, receiving water. So there's sunlight, there's water, there's earth. Plants go into the body of ourselves or other animals. We eat the plants or the animals or their products. And the invitation is to feel that there's a constant stream of contact here, that which grows in the earth enters our bodies and becomes our bodies. And of course, let's take a moment and include the other side of the equation just to link ourselves to the earth. Think for a moment about your shit and piss, and just know that it goes back to the earth. Right? Wherever we put it, however we process it, it becomes dirt. It becomes dirt and liquid, with minerals and stuff. And that stuff goes back into the earth and more stuff grows. Even the air we breathe, you breathe in the exhales of the trees and you breathe out and the trees breathe in your exhale. And to finish this up, see perhaps if you can sense that your body is completely not even in relationship to the earth or in relationship to the plants, but actually is simply the fruiting body of the earth of this particular form. Our bodies came out of our parents' bodies and fed by food. Here we are. None of that is at all separate from the earth. And so we are mushroom-like, just these sprouting up bodies of the one substance that is the earth. One vast, complex substance made of so much difference, but also one interwoven process. Take a moment and just see what that feels like. And particularly, see if you can, this is just a little bit of magic, but see if you can shift your consciousness just slightly into feeling your plant, animal, earthy nature. All right. You can come back out into your ordinary, gorgeous self if you like. If you want to drop into the chat, just any couple words, if you got a flash of what that feels like in the body, maybe give us a couple words about what that felt like, if there was anything really different about that. And now I want to do a different layer of that same thing. While we talk, notice that you're hearing words. So you can do this almost in the background as folks are putting in some words. The first words to come in, sweaty, grimy. Yeah, totally. The earth and the dirt and the food, it's totally dirty, grimy, right? Grounded. Yeah. Here's an interesting one. I felt equal with all things. Equal is such a beautiful word here, because part of what we're pointing to actually is that the human thing is not actually special in relation to other things. It's not more special than a beetle or a redwood tree or a rain cloud. It is totally special in its various ways, but it's not of a different nature than that. And I want to point again, with no malice toward the Judeo-Christian tradition, but I want to point to the ancient roots of the idea that we are separate, right? If you grew up in one of those traditions, you might have heard or read, you know, in the book of Genesis, in the first book of the Bible or the Torah, that, you know, God created all of these animals and then created man. I'll put the gendered term for humanity in quotes, but it was first a gendered man, according to that particular patriarchal myth, to take care of the animals and the plants, but also to have dominion over them. This really troublesome old word, dominion, you know. Really, this is a vision of humans as being radically separate from the animals. Other things that come in, insubstantial, inseparable, juicy and huge. Yeah, totally. That's partly how I feel about it. Unattached. Rebooted, I like. Yes, good. Reboot your operating system doing this. So shifting a little bit to the mind, like often we think like, okay, my body's not me, I'm going to die. But, you know, maybe I grew up Christian. I did, in fact, grow up Catholic. You know, I'm going to go to heaven, hopefully, God willing. And, the body doesn't go there, but the soul does. So it might be something that happens deep in our heart minds. When we do this, it's initially easy to understand the body as earth and inseparable from all of the earthy things, the plants and animals and fungi and all that. But then we might unconsciously probably think something like, well, yeah, but my mind or my personality or my consciousness is not of the earth in that way. We won't do it as a meditation in the same way, but I want to encourage you to do so. It goes a little bit like this. Notice that all the words you use, you learned from somewhere. You might have made up one or two along the way, but you did them within a system in which they would be understandable. And all the concepts that you use, you learned. And all of that learning, you know, wasn't invented by anyone. Like, there was no one person who invented language or who invented a given concept. Concepts appeared like the fruiting bodies of minds at different times, you know, coming together, flowering as something, an idea about, you know, justice, or an idea called home, or an idea called ownership, or an idea called love, or an idea called truth. Like, all of these ideas arose in human culture in many different ways in different places, like mushrooms popping up from what we might think of as a vast interconnected web of thought in a certain way, thought, feeling, thinking, feeling, knowing. There's a kind of consciousness component to earthiness, clearly. Animals of all different kinds clearly think about things and feel things, have emotions, have ideas, build structures, have social structures. These things are natural and they're not just human. So if the body and the mind can be, we can shift our perception away from being like, this is my individual body and this is my individual personality and myself, into this is the fruiting body of the earth and this is the fruiting mind of earth consciousness in a way. Where this can lead is into an extraordinarily earthy way of thinking about this concept of the Buddhas of endless return. We think of rebirth as like, oh, I was this kind of being and then that kind of being. It's very hard to think outside of limited individual type sequences, you know, oh, maybe I was this kind of person in my last life or this kind of being or animal. But when the Buddha describes it, he says, like, yes, there's that, but that's sort of like saying, you know, I collected these three mushrooms on my trip, you know, into the forest and my foraging trip. You know, I found one false belief and one moral and three poisonous little brown things that I couldn't identify. You know, that's like three individual lives. That's nothing compared to the mycelium. When the Buddha talks about his past lives, he talks about, this is how he says it is, I remember my past lives, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, a cosmic eon, countless cosmic eons of expansion and contraction. In other words, not just this universe that began with the Big Bang and you know, gazillions of beings being conscious and arising as flowering bodies as a result of this creation, but the entire universe expanding and contracting over the course of infinite stretches of time without beginning. The Buddha says, I can see there's no conceivable beginning to the universe. When you think about rebirth on that scale, it's obvious that we're not talking about like an individual moving through things. We're actually talking about a conscious universe knowing itself in an endlessly repetitive, iterative, constantly unfolding way. And the Buddha says, this is what you've been doing. Whether you accept that or not as a as an idea, and it's a totally wild idea. This is one way, I'll say this differently, it's not what you've been doing, but this is one way to describe the experience of being conscious that you have. Is that you can actually, with your sensitivity as this kind of being, you can actually learn to sense your pathway through all the things of the universe forever. You've been here forever. We've all been here forever. There's no we all or you all. There's no language way to talk about this. But the experience is that there's been something going on forever that fluctuates through all these microscopic differences. You've been every kind of being. The Tibetans really go to town on this one. They've been like every being in the universe. You've been their mother, their father, their brother, their sister, their child, their lover, their parent, every combination of relatedness, enemy, friend. It's a good meditation for when our minds are really contracted into self and other, enemy and friend. But where this is going is that there's a state of heart-mind that I think is at the heart of the Dharma and profoundly important right now in this moment in humanity where human actions are in some ways, you know, extraordinarily beautiful and in other ways cataclysmically destructive for our planet in the short term, meaning maybe the next million years. Short term in the sense of endless cosmic eons, right? Like climate change is not a problem for the Buddha. For us, it is, because our actions matter. One of the ways to wake up to how deeply our actions matter is to get out of the individual frame. And this is a pathway out of the individual frame. And it's vaster than like metta or loving kindness. When we do deep Brahma, when you do deep Brahma Vihara practice, it goes here. But ordinary meditations on loving kindness or compassion often don't dislodge the sense of being a separate self. I have the sense of myself radiating loving kindness to all beings. May you be happy. May you be happy. May you be safe. And if I go through the whole process, my friends, my neutral people, my difficult people, if you do that kind of sequence, all beings everywhere, human, non-human, may they be happy, may you be happy, may we be happy. The pronouns start, the prepositions start to fall apart here. What I'm pointing to, I think, is like a shortcut to universally vast metta. And the shortcut is to forget about your individuality for a moment and become a member of the universe, to not be separate from the universe anymore, to really heal from the, what I'm going to call now, again, with bows to the traditional my origin, but what I'm going to call a trauma that was set in motion by the idea of the separate individual who has dominion over the earth. And so we can do this anywhere because it's not about particular kinds of beings. You know, you can look around and you could see certainly the greenery that's around you, if there's trees or bushes or houseplants or whatever you got. See that living thing's relationship to you. But you can do it with inanimate things. See the rock or the wood, the drywall and paint that you're, that are probably surrounding you if you're inside. These are just minerals, elements that came from the earth. Inside our bodies, there's all these other beings, all the bacteria and things, right? They're just beings like us. They have lives, they have cultures, they have drama. Right now, many of us, many of us as humans are in this, kind of deep, intimate relationship, with, this, species of virus, that we call the coronavirus. It's just a being. It's a number of, it's a lot of beings who have a certain way of living. Their way of living is colliding with our way of living in ways that are uncomfortable right now. For both of us, I think. I'm not entirely sure how they feel. But what we can do here is, it's like the first step, I'll finish with this and I'll take a couple questions. The first step in a practice like this is to consider the possibility of, as the comment came in when we did the exercise with the body and food, to consider the possibility of our being equal with all things, right? Of not being, this is the Buddhist way of saying this would be recover from a superiority conceit, from thinking that as a human, I'm better than other animals, or that I'm more alive than a rock, or that in any way, I'm creating a kind of barrier between myself and the world. Conceptually, usually unconscious, almost entirely unconsciously. So a first way to do this is basic mindfulness with a kind of tone to it of intimacy and friendship. So it's not just that I'm aware of seeing the screen and your faces, but I actually want to recognize that my body and my mind and my concepts are absolutely inseparable from the table, the computer, all of these elements, everything that went into making them, all of you people and all of you spirit beings who are here, all of the plant beings that are around. This is essentially a radical setting down of boundary. And because it is that, it's I have to take a tiny tangent to be trauma sensitive and say, radically setting down boundaries is a profound mystical practice. It's not a human relational practice. So there's nothing in this that's asking you to drop your appropriate social boundaries in relation to harmful people or places or other, you know, animals or whatnot. Just because I feel one with the forest doesn't mean I'm going to go get all intimate with the poison oak if I can help it, or the fire ants, or the hornets that have a nest out in the redwoods behind my house, or some people that live down the street who look like they don't share my culture in a way that their actions might be harmful to me, right? people I might perceive as dangerous. Dropping my boundary with all of existence doesn't mean I invite those people into my house or go into theirs or watch, or I stop watching out when I walk around at night. So don't confuse those two realms. Yeah. Have appropriate boundaries to protect your body and those you love, all that, your mind and your heart. This is something to do when you're in a safe place with good people and you can actually take a moment to drop being vigilant. Right. So that's different for all of us because our histories of danger are different. But when you're in a moment when you can do that, see what it's like to bring in the feeling of friendliness for all things, but not as an isolated person broadcasting friendliness, but almost like the friendliness is so friendly that I just let go of being a different person than this. Me and the chair and the room and the woods that are around me and the air and the animals are just one field of stuff vibrating. A next step is to recognize that all of it is awake in a certain way. Some of it is awake in a very different way than us, like rocks, hard to tell, but you can talk to them. And be polite. In general, it's good to be polite with everything, right? The same way you would with people. And then, so deep friendliness, dropping the sense of separateness, and you can do a lot of this just through feeling the sense of your own body being wide, bigger. And someone said juicy and huge. Someone else said insubstantial. These are all ways of saying, you know, what it feels like when the vigilance part of my boundary gets to soften. And I'm just not bracing against the world. And the last step of this I'll say for now is in relation to time. And this is to consider that all of the elements that went into making us these bodies, but also all of the elements that went into our heart-mind consciousnesses, all of the concepts, for instance, predate us by a long time. They will outlast us by a long time, right? The concept of justice isn't going anywhere for a long time until humans figure out what to do with it. It's part of the fruiting body of who we are. So all of these concepts, mind and body, came from this vast ancestry, complex, evolving, and that it has no beginning. And that means you have no beginning. You know, that means the thing that I experience as myself is this momentary flowering that that's just the visible tip of an ancient, universally vast and infinitely long vibrating experience. And you can tune into this. It's not actually that hard to tune into. It's challenging to stabilize, but it's not that hard to tune into. And so, so the invitation is, because we know something about how to recognize similarity and difference, we can actually use this to put down the small or relative human differences that mostly occupy our dramas, relational and political, and tune into the vast ness that we partake in, that we are an intimate part of, whether we admit it or not. And I'll propose that this is what the Buddha, this is one way of thinking about what the Buddha saw when he saw all of his past lives. And when he used the words like interdependent and empty and conditioned to describe our experience. And the last thing I'll say is that practicing in this way, I think, is really sweet. And it has a kind of intimacy, and I'll use the word again because I used it once earlier. It has a kind of eros to it, because we're not observing the world from a distance. mindfulness can sometimes seem like we're just observing from a sort of perch, you know, with like a fire lookout. But we're not. We're observing from being absolutely embedded in the thing. And so there's no, there's no place to go to observe without being yourself part of the phenomena. And so it's profoundly intimate. It's sweaty and grimy and earthy and tasty and, you know, food flavored. So we can practice in this way, and it both enriches the sense of an intimacy with all that lives, which is everything. I think begins to work on that ancient trauma of separateness that was never ours, but that we've inherited, almost all of us. And it's one of the deepest tasks to work through, I think, as practitioners. All right. Pause there. Thank you so much for your warm attention to a wide-ranging, slightly cosmic talk. I wasn't entirely sure where I was going to go, but I felt something, so I went toward it. And we have 10 minutes before noon, and I'm happy to hear some questions or responses. Tom B, please.
John, thank you so much. Yeah, what a far-ranging talk. I'm going to go back and listen to it again and again. One of the things I miss most about being in the Bay Area since I moved away is the chai tea that you used to serve at your sangha.
Oh,
I'd only been a few times, but delicious. So it occurs to me that what you're talking about, you know, goes way beyond just trying to understand karma and rebirth. It goes beyond pantheism. It's like the cessation of all boundaries. And I just feel like this is a great mindset to have to help us overcome fear of death, mm-hmm. which is something that everybody struggles with.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if there's a question in there, but I mean, that's how I sort of take it and unpack this.
Yeah. I'm really happy to hear that from you. I think that's exactly what the Buddha was pointing toward, right? In a certain way, we could diagnose the pre-awakened Buddha as being a guy who was afraid of dying. Like that's what he says he's searching for the deathless. So he's absolutely talking about that and, you know, how we deal with the inevitability of death and loss. I miss serving chai too. There was this one moment in like February of 2020. We were still meeting live in Berkeley, and I had this whole tea set. Every week we would come in, there's tea, we would share cups, you know, I mean, not in the same moment, we would wash them, of course, the same way y'all do in the mission. But I totally remember the moment where I was talking with one of my Sangha members, and I was like, how are we going to do this? How are we going to this thing that seems to be happening, we have to start taking care with like washing everything and more. And my Sangha member said, I think sharing teacups is over for now. And I was just like, oh, you're right. I could totally see like, oh, you're right. That's, you know, I just have to take the tea set home for now, you know? So yeah, this is vast. You mentioned pantheism. I'll just to say the term, for those, if you're not familiar with it, pantheism, many, many gods, many, many forms of divinity. What I'm pointing to, I think, might be resonant with the term that the scholar of religion and Asian religions, Mircea Eliade, from the University of Chicago, used. Great anthropologist, philosopher. He used the term. I think coined the term panentheism. Panentheism, meaning not many gods, but God or divinity or true nature in everything. I want to hear Marvin's question, and I'll just say to a question that came in through the chat: does contemporary Buddhism have any comment on extraterrestrial creatures? The very brief answer is lots of us based in the Buddha's description of other realms and beings of all kinds, material, immaterial. And I have no problem readily assuming that many, many kinds of beings exist in the universe. There's, in the same way that there's no reason that humans should be the special species created to have dominion over the earth, there's also no reason for me to think that in a vast, infinitely vast universe with gazillions of planets like ours and other kinds, that there wouldn't be manifestations of life everywhere. It would be absurd for it to be otherwise. It's a Christian trauma, I think, to think that it would be otherwise. Marvin, please.
Sean, I just wanted to thank you for such a wonderful, delicious Dharma. It was really great.
Yeah. Great. I'm so happy to hear it.
I just want to say thanks as well, Sean, and say that I think we have time for one more question.
Let's see. Chris, go for it.
I realized as you started talking, I probably should have had a power drink with a lot of glucose in it. Boy, that was very detailed stuff early on a Sunday morning. I was ready to collapse. I don't know if I have questions so much. I did a quick review of your website last night, which is pretty impressive, not your bio alone. But also, I listened to some of your talks on YouTube, and I really learned quite a lot. Thanks so much for them. I got a little taste of your Dharma and your delivery. I just thought briefly if you could define how you're using Eros right now. I certainly run a run to a Greek dictionary now, look it up, and then see how it sort of transforms Western civilization. Thank you for the talk.
You're welcome. Yeah. I use Eros to a little bit casually, but a sort of casual version of how it has come down from Greek philosophy through Jung, primarily through the visionary thinker Carl Jung. But and I'm not going to go Jungian on you for here in the last 2 minutes of our time together. but I think it's a good word for pointing to how there's a profound and very deep instinct that we share as that we seem to share as humans, but many kinds of animals share this. Maybe particularly mammals are the ones that I'm most familiar with, but other kinds of beings and spirits undoubtedly have Eros in their own ways. That it's like an impulse. It's the profound innate impulse toward connection and intimacy. So, if psyche, which is often sort of paired with Eros in the Greek thing, is something like the deep faculty we have for understanding, for concepts, for structures and systems, Eros might be the deep faculty we have for making contact. And so Eros is anything where I use Eros to mean anything where the contact is almost like where the contactfulness of the sensory experience is foregrounded. So like when I'm being mindful, this comes back to the mindfulness thing. When I'm being mindful of something, like I'm seeing, the trees outside my window, traditional Burmese mindfulness, if you did noting practice, might be like seeing. I'm just noting seeing. And I'm hanging out in the kind of just the naming side. What I would say here is like, I'm hanging out in psyche. I know what's happening. It's helpful for me particularly if I get really lost in the seeing, to be like, oh, I'm just seeing. And maybe I see Vedana, I see pleasant, unpleasant. I go, I see the rubber trees, it's pleasant. I see the other things, unpleasant, whatever. That's really a kind of witness-oriented approach. Dialing up the Eros in it might mean, for instance, dialing down the emphasis on pure perception, like there's just seeing, and I might be like, there's seeing, but I can also shift channels into like a kind of intimacy with like, how you and me, you tree beings and me kind of, we're breathing each other. We're actually in contact. Our bodies are flowing into each other, right? The out breath of the redwoods flows in through my nose. I can smell it if I step outside my door, given the blessing of living near the forest here. Eros is to go, is to not just be like, oh, smelling, but to be like, me and you, redwood being, and moss beings, and, you know, and skunk down the way, and my friends over there, I'm going to let you in, right? Eros is like, I'm going to let you into my body. And then let is the wrong word. It's actually just going to be, I'm going to admit that you're already in here. I'm going to, and that means, I'm just using awareness. I'm going to tune my awareness to the frequency of, here's a sexy word for you, interpenetration. Right? That we all are in each other. And so Eros is going to be emphasize that side. Psyche is going to be emphasize the understanding and seeing and kind of structural side. Yeah. Something like that. All right. Heavy philosophy. Noon on a Sunday. So we'll do our formal close here to be on time. I'll stick around for a few minutes if folks have more other questions or a bit of socializing. Stick around for 10 or 15, and it sounds like you all stick around for a little more after that. So I'll just thank you for, again, your presence, your participation, whatever in this Dharma that's coming through is helpful for you. May it be deeply helpful. Whatever is not helpful for you, may it fall away. And may our practice individually, together, and as the scintillating, fruiting bodies of this great watery earth, may it be for the benefit of all that lives, which is everything, everywhere, always. May we awaken to the deathless and soon, because the world needs us in our clearest hearts and minds right now. Oh, may everyone be well. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Shen. I just would like to remind everyone that GBF relies on Donna. And then I wanted to check in if there are any other announcements today.
Despite no birth, happy birthday to Stephen and Jeff. And who else? Who's today's birthday? I knew it before I left. Happy birthday, everyone.
Richard.
Richard, that's right.
Wow, happy birthday. And I was going to ask, Sean, if you want to, I know that, actually, Chris, did you have an announcement?
Yeah, I just want to say I'm helping with scheduling speakers in the future, and I've gotten some great responses from folks. We have a big crowd today, and we're at like 47. That's a lot showing up. If any of you folks have friends or Dharma teachers you want to invite to this, please let us know and I'll try to contact them to bring them in. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Also, I'm sorry, I'll put in another, I should start doing this weekly, a plug for, we receive letters from incarcerated prisoners, incarcerated gay Buddhists. We send them our newsletters and we get many requests for pen pals. And so if you're available to donate a little time and energy to that, let me know. You can sign up. You can look through the letters we've received and write prisoners directly, or you can sign up with Jeffrey through the San Francisco Zen Center to become a regular pen pal. There's a long waiting list, so you could take it from the top or you could sneak in and cherry pick. So text me or ping me if you would like to be a pen pal.
Thank you, Grisha. Jeff?
I just want to say on that note, you know, GBF has a number of people involved in keeping this all running, and we want to invite anyone who wants to be involved in a general pool to help out, to just let me or Grisha or Cass or Jerry Jones or who am I forgetting, Richard, Greg, let us know, and we'll gather your names. And sometimes we have, you know, like the newsletter folding stuff, that's for everybody, but little projects and maybe more if you're interested. So it's a good way to engage and connect. So thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Sean, I just want to check, like, we will dedicate the merit now. Like, would you like to offer dedication of merit?
Sure. I'll do one. Yeah, happy to. I'll sing the traditional verse for dedicating merit in Pali, and then I'll say a short translation. Sambe sata sadahantu avera sukha jivino kattaham punya palam maiham sabe bhagi pavantu te hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sab devata saba buddhanu bhavena soti hontu nirantaram hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu saba devata saba dhammanu bhavena soti hontu nirantaram hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu saba devata saba sanghanu bhavena soti hontu nirantaram. May all beings be at peace and be safe. May the blessings or merit that arise as a result of our practice be for the benefit of all. May there be every good blessing. May the devas protect you. By the power of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, may you forever be well.
Thanks, Sean. Thank Juan.
Thank you, everyone. I'll leave the room open for whoever wants to chat in the next minutes.
Sean, I just want to thank you for a wonderful. It starts out with the deathless, and then does a lap like that. Really, is very moving, and that we're all, you know, fruiting bodies, as you know, reminds me of Alan Watts. You know, that we're all peopling, you could say.
That old trickster. He got this.
Yeah. Right. Right. And the main Judeo-Christian source of my own sense of separation was that principle that Christ died for our sins, you know, yeah, that we're immediately guilty by some higher body. Yeah. So.
Yeah. That myth really cut a swath in the world. Deep reality has a way of making itself known no matter what worldview you have. And so, you know, of course, there are the Christian mystics who went deep. Of course, they go to not self, like they go to the divine marriage where you become the bride of Christ. And then beyond that into, you know, the most inner chamber of this, and this is St. Teresa of Avila, if anyone wants to go there, into her multi-chambered palace where you move closer and closer to Christ, becoming the bride of Christ, and then eventually becoming essentially not separate from what we can now call sort of Christ consciousness, right? And the Christian church, you know, if you go too far toward that, if you actually go out and proclaim that you are Christ, you know, they don't like that.
Yeah.
Because mystics in any tradition don't fit well within orthodoxy. And that's true for all of the great religious, too, for the Buddhists as well, you know. But, you know, it's certainly true for, you know, the Sufi mystics who were problematic for mainstream Islam, for the Christian mystics who were problematic, for the Jewish mystics who were problematic, you know, for those in, you know, those traditions. If you know, go and really, really feel, connect with the spirit of someone like the Baal Shem Tov, you know, the great Eastern European Jewish mystic, and you get this kind of profound not separateness and things, you know, and different ways of worshiping the world. But the Christ transaction, you know, there's some way that I don't want to diminish it by just saying that it was the source of trauma. Mm-hmm. What I might say is certain interpretations of that story have given rise to a lot of trauma. There are other ways to understand it, like anything mystical, you know, mm-hmm. and that figure was clearly a profound mystic, you know, whoever we might say that the human Jesus was, you know. Likewise, the Buddha, like, we have these stories, but like, who was this guy traveling to heaven realms to teach his mom because she died when he was 7 days old? And, you know, so I don't know what this guy's doing. It's really, really out there. But what a force, you know, each of these beings, you know, brought on the channels of the world.
John, what is your website?
It's my full name, seanfightoaks.com. And so you can search for that and you'll find it. It needs a little updating. We're working on that, but there's stuff there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, Sean, I'd love to get your perspective on something.
Sure.
I was so glad you mentioned the tree, you know, interacting with the tree, because I came to realize a while back that the longest relationship I ever had in my life was with a ficus that I had in my indoor space. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like 25 years of me breathing out carbon dioxide that became, you know, the structure of the plant. It was incorporated into its body and it would give me oxygen and back and forth. And yep. I mean, it was really profound. And I would meditate next to it every day. My space was right there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we look at plants as sources of medicine for us and what they can give us and nutrition and this and that and the other, or trees, you know, the tree spirits, how they can help us and stuff, but we never, well, I wouldn't say never. It's rare to hear anybody talk about how they, you know, a human is going to be medicine for a tree, mm-hmm. or, you know, spiritually or whatever, other than our technologies of irrigation and fertilizer and this sort of thing. Your far-ranging thoughts on everything you presented today, I have to believe you have some thoughts about that.
You know, a bit of how I'm talking about this today, is in part indebted to some beautiful teachers teaching in the animist space right now, particularly a teacher named Dr. Daniel Foer. And the term that he uses mostly is friendship. You know, it's like hearing the story about, you know, you and that ficus, like, and this is often true with ficuses, you know, our beloved long-living indoor houseplants. You know, I kind of want to say, what a beautiful friendship. And one of the practices that you can do is that, well, you don't even have to be medicine for each other, although we are medicine for each other as friends all the time. But you might be just like, well, we're actually just friends. You know, we live together. We're housemates, you know? And so you could do the practice of talking to things, you know?
Yeah. I actually did that. When I moved one time, I had to move to a place where this tree in San Francisco would have to reside in an outdoor patio, and it had been indoors. And, you know, ficus are notorious for going through trauma when they're moved or shifted to a new environment or something. And so I sat down and I meditated and I sort of asked it, you know, do you want to come or do you want me to like let you go? And so in my garage sale or my sidewalk sale, the next door neighbors took it. And the irony is I got that ficus from an abandoned office building in Southern California, moved it to Northern California through like 5 or 6 different moves. And it said it was ready to go. And the guys who took it were moving to Southern California and taking it back down to warmer climates.
You know, it's lovely. It's lovely being friends with things and, you know, and to
express great friendship.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And, you know, a really beautiful practice to do in relation to stories like this beautiful one you just told is to just use human relational words for non-human things. So you could be like, oh yeah, this plant that, you know, we had this long relationship, it was an orphan, you know, or, you know, it had childhood trauma, you know, it was an abandoned, you know, person. And I took it in, we had this beautiful relationship, you know.
I love that.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. No, for sure. Tom, hey.
Yes. Thank you, Sean. That was really, it seemed like it was hearkening back to my college days of reading Ken Wilber, No Boundary. And I was thinking during your talk that I've kind of befriended some, I live down here very isolated, very sort of a monk-like existence, but I've befriended the birds outside my window, and I've actually been putting the, you know, those suet blocks and things, and there's scads of these ladderback woodpeckers and all these beautiful Pyralexia from Mexico that were 20 miles away from the border. And I've got all these birds swarming. It's almost gotten out of hand, but they've been wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say also that I, for the first time, I think ever, I made homemade mushroom soup last night. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you could tell, I was just oozing mushroom spore all during your talk.
There you go. Now you're flirting. Mushrooms are totally magical, strange, wild beings. You know, not quite plant, not quite animal. Like,
yeah.
Okay. They're getting good press lately. You know, in a good way. a beautiful kind of being to have a relationship with.
Weren't psilocybin either.
Yeah, for sure. Much more than. Those are great too, but much more than. I've been taking my kid out mushroom hunting in the woods near here, near the coast, and
wow.
You know, filling up baskets with things. So
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. If there's nothing else burning, I'm going to duck out, and I'll wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Lovely to see y'all. Take good care.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.